I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue 1 last year.
I know, by a wide margin too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome to a special episode of All Things Mysterious, the Halloween special. Today we have a special double episode for you. First, we'll talk about Ed Gein. Was he a serial killer, or was he just a creepy guy? Then, we'll talk about my favorite, Jack the Ripper. So stay tuned and enjoy. Remember to like and subscribe. It helps us out a lot. Happy Halloween.
Welcome to another intriguing episode of All Things Mysterious, the podcast where all the realms of true crime, supernatural, and the unexplained converge. I'm your host, Jordan.
I'm Matt.
We're ready to plunge into today's fascinating mysteries. Let's dive right in.
So I don't know much about this story. I do know that it's the basis of a movie. Now I forgot which movie it was. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre?
Kind of. So more than anything, and I'll get this towards the end, but Ed and his acts were more of the inspiration for several movies, or the villain of the movie, if you will. But not necessarily his story. Well, kind of.
I think it was the writer or director or producer of Texas Chainsaw Massacre said that it was kind of inspired by Ed Gein, but obviously they changed a lot of stuff for the story. I don't really know much about him, honestly. And that's kind of surprising because I'm usually pretty big into like serial killer type things.
So funny story, obviously we'll get more into it, but Ed actually isn't a serial killer, not really.
Really?
Really.
I thought he was.
Surprisingly, no. Did he do some really heinous and disgusting things? Absolutely. But no, he's actually technically not a serial killer.
Yeah, I did not know that. Guess I really don't know anything about him. I've obviously heard the name before. I think pretty much everybody has. But I'm interested to learn. And I might actually pay attention to this one while you're telling it.
You better, because let me tell you, this man had a weird life. Edward Gein, commonly known as Ed, was born on August 27th, 1906. He had an older brother, Henry, and throughout both of their childhoods in Plainfield, Wisconsin, they suffered at the hands of their parents. It was a marriage, at best, of convenience and not love, and even in the 1900s, people questioned their marriage. Their father was an alcoholic, which only got worse over time with the control of his wife and couldn't keep a job, while their mother was extremely religious and both refused to leave their father, but also held contempt for Ed and Henry, believing they too would end up like their father. She held extreme hatred for men, going as far as to belittle and criticize every single thing the kids did. The boys were allowed to go to school, but not allowed friends, only to go to school, come home, and work on the farm. An important note is that their mother also instilled in them that sex and lust were horribly sinful. This led both Ed and Henry to lead extremely lonely lives, depending solely on each other, their father, and their mother, who actually kind of hated them for any kind of emotional support. For whatever reason, Ed, over time, began to show unwavering support for his mother's ideals and grew very close with her, which meant growing apart from Henry, as Henry resented her teachings and beliefs. This was what his mother wanted, for Ed to solely rely on her. Their father passed away in 1940, leaving Ed and Henry to be the breadwinners of the home. At this point, the farm, which had never really been profitable, was in bad financial shape. Henry and Ed had to take on odd jobs around town to keep it up. They took on handiwork, and at some point, Ed actually found himself babysitting. It's believed that because Ed wasn't allowed to be social during his childhood, it was easier for him to understand children. During this time, Ed and Henry got slightly closer due to their father's death, and this is when Ed realized Henry did not feel the same way about their mother as he did. Ed adored her. He would do anything to keep her affection and be in her good graces. But Henry hated her and only followed her orders because he was terrified of her. In 1944, a fire broke out at their home. Both Henry and Ed attempted to put out the fire, but only Ed made it out. When firefighters went to find Henry, Ed led the search right to him. He wasn't burnt, but had bruising on his body, and while it seemed suspicious, his death was ruled as either asphyxiation or a heart attack. As suspicious as it may seem that Ed led them directly to his body, and that Henry had not been burnt in the fire at all, yet still died, Ed never admitted to killing him. Things didn't improve much for Ed at this point. He was left alone with his mom, and a year later, she suffered a stroke. This didn't kill her, but she was then on bed rest. She had a second stroke in 1945 and passed away, which seemed to be Ed's complete undoing. He found odd jobs around town to try and keep himself afloat, but he was truly not doing well. He seemed to begin to lose himself in horror stories and magazines as an escape. Ed was horribly alone, and because of his isolation, both in how he was raised and how he followed his mother's word to a T, no one checked up on him. Ed's first victim, Mary Hogan, a tavern owner, had managed to catch Ed's eye, even though Ed had concerning views on women. Her strong personality was said to resemble, in a way, his mother's. The night of December 8, 1954, she went missing from the tavern. The next day, a resident found the tavern empty and bloodstained, as well as rifled through with money missing. They also found a .38 caliber bullet casing and presumed she would be found dead. The neighbors had seen a truck roughly matching Ed's around the time of her disappearance, but it would be quite some time before she would ever be found. Ed's second victim was a woman named Bernice Warden. She owned and ran a hardware store, and Ed had been frequenting it. But one particular morning, Ed decided she was his next victim. He went into the store, made a purchase, then asked to see a rifle for which he'd brought his own ammunition, aimed it at her head, and shot. Bernice's son, who ran the store with her, found her missing and found the last receipt with Ed's name on it. The sheriff found it odd enough to look into, and they found Ed to ask him about his whereabouts. He recounted his story, but it changed the second time around, and when called out, he immediately said, "I was framed." So of course, police were like, "How about we look further into this?" and checked out the Dean farm. It's about to get gross, so listeners, be warned. Bernice's headless body was hanging upside down, cut open to bleed out like you would a deer. But there's more. Searching further, they found several sawed-off tops of human skulls being used as bowls, a couple of full skeletons, Human skin used as chair coverings. A corset made from human skin. A belt made from human nipples. Four noses. Just noses. A pair of lips on a window shade drawstring. A lampshade made from human face skin. Masks made from human faces. And of course, both Bernie's and Mary's heads. While Ed only admitted to two murders, he did also admit to many grave robberies. There are also several missing persons cases Ed is potentially tied to, but has never admitted to. 8-year-old Georgia Weckler and 15-year-old Evelyn Hartley being the main two, but police found none of their belongings in his home. Ed, of course, was charged with first-degree murder in the case of Bernice Warden. He was held at the nearby jail for questioning, but when questioned, just beat his head on the wall repeatedly. He did answer some questions, but claimed a lapse of memory on some things, such as if he intended to eat his victims. While he was found mentally sane for the trial, he did ask for no jury. The trial began in November of 1968, and he was found guilty of the murder of Bernice Warden. However, doctors insisted he was not mentally sane, and he pled not guilty due to insanity at a second trial. And Ed Gein was then diagnosed with schizophrenia and spent the remainder of his days in the Central State Hospital for the Criminally Insane. Even though he admitted to the murder of Mary Hogan, he was not charged. After his sentencing, his farm went up for auction, but it mysteriously caught fire, suspected to be arson, on March 20th, 1958, just 10 days before it was set to auction off. Ed passed away from lung cancer at 77 years old on July 26, 1984, leaving the world wondering what truly went on in his mind to do such horrific things. That being said, many people learned of Ed Gein's acts through news and media and gained inspiration for their own creepy movies or shows. Texas Chainsaw Massacre was heavily influenced by Ed Gein's human face mask collection, giving the idea for Leatherface. Norman Bates from Psycho was also influenced by Ed Gein and his super creepy, controlling, yet way too involved infatuation with his mother. Several serial killers, including Ed Gein, even though he technically wasn't a serial killer, were the inspiration for The Silence of the Lambs, citing his obsession with female flesh and skin suits. Unknowingly, Ed started a new revolution of horror movies with his disgusting and horrifying murders.
I would argue he is a serial killer.
Technically, it's only two.
Technically, a serial killer is killing two or more victims.
Yeah. I mean, it's two or more. The rest of it was all just robbing graves for parts, which is really icky. Just ew.
To be fair, I mean, they weren't using them anymore.
Just ew. I mean, the stuff that they found in that house, and I probably should have added this, but the house did not have electricity, so it smelled so bad. From what I understand, the house was like a complete hoarder nightmare. And when they were going through it, it was just literally like, oh, what random human skin product are we gonna find over here?
I remember the part of it about finding all the like stuff in his house, all the skin products and stuff. This guy is creepy as fuck, to say the least. I can't imagine like having all that stuff made out of human skin.
People let him babysit their children.
I promise you, I definitely would not do that. I guess I'm just trying to picture it in my head. Like, human skin is not very, like, appealing. I don't think it looked good as a lampshade.
Ed sure thought that it did.
I'm not, like, a huge fan of, like, leather in general.
I'm a fan of leather in the way that if you are going to use an animal, I believe you should use all of it. I just can't imagine when the police went in there what they saw. Because, like I said, he didn't have electricity. And they were going in there with, like, torches and just true nightmare material.
I'm pretty sure they might have had flashlights back then, didn't they?
I had torch, flashlight, same thing in my head. I don't know why I'm using, like, the British term in my head.
When this all take place?
Like, 1940s.
I used to watch old TV shows that took place in, like, the 40s, 50s, and 60s. Pretty sure they had flashlights back then.
Regardless, any sort of flash of light revealing, you know, a headless body cut open and hanging, that's gonna scar you for the rest of your life.
This guy is definitely weird. I really hate this guy was convicted of killing two people, but he was suspected of killing more, but we never figured out if he did or not. And in this case, it's worse because he was convicted of one,
admitted to the second one but wasn't convicted. That doesn't make sense to me. I assume that there's probably a reason why, but if he's going to admit to it.
Yeah, I don't remember the actual reasoning on it. I looked it up several times, and I truly could not figure it out. And it bothers me. I know, obviously, they found the evidence on it, but I don't remember the actual reasoning.
The funny part is when you were telling the story about the gun shop owner, when he was saying he was framed, I was actually kind of thinking that it sounded a little weird. Like, he went in there, got a gun, and then shot her, and they had a record that he was the last person that she sold a gun to.
No, before that, he bought something else.
I guess it just seems weird to me.
Yeah.
On the surface, it really does almost feel like it was kind of a setup.
It might be, till they went back to the farm, and then they were like, oh, how about that?
Where is her body found? In the barn?
I think it was called the summer kitchen. I don't exactly know what the summer kitchen is. Houses were built different back then.
Like a sunroom?
Sure, why not? I have no idea.
This guy, obviously, even if he didn't kill anybody, this guy was 10 shades of weird.
Well, and like, he was raised so screwed up. He was raised completely antisocial with parents that straight up didn't love him, like, at all. He wasn't even allowed to have friends, ever, at all. Go to school, come home, work on the farm.
People suck anyways.
I mean, they were beaten, too. His mom would beat them. His dad was an alcoholic. As much as, I hate to say it, like, he was definitely gonna grow up to be not right in the head. I don't know if for sure he would have grown up to be like this no matter what, but he was not gonna grow up to be right.
I'm 100% antisocial. Honestly, recording these podcasts, even though it's just with Jordan, my social battery is depleted for the entire week. I definitely have social anxiety, so I can feel the antisocial part. I don't like socializing. It's torture, being in the room with a bunch of people. Like, that's why I never really cared for parties as much, you know. But I'm also not a serial killer, and I wouldn't kill anybody. The funny part is when you were telling the story about the gun shop owner, when he was saying he was framed, I was actually kind of thinking that it sounded a little weird. Like, he went in there, got a gun, and then shot her, and they had a record that he was the last person that she sold a gun to.
No, before that, he bought something else.
I guess it just seems weird to me.
Yeah.
On the surface, it really does almost feel like it was kind of a setup.
It might be, till they went back to the farm, and then they were like, oh, how about that?
Where is her body found? In the barn?
I think it was called the summer kitchen. I don't exactly know what the summer kitchen is. Houses were built different back then.
Like a sunroom?
Sure, why not? I have no idea.
This guy, obviously, even if he didn't kill anybody, this guy was 10 shades of weird.
Well, and like, he was raised so screwed up. He was raised completely antisocial with parents that straight up didn't love him, like, at all. He wasn't even allowed to have friends, ever, at all. Go to school, come home, work on the farm.
People suck anyways.
I mean, they were beaten too. His mom would beat them. His dad was an alcoholic. As much as, I hate to say it, like, he was definitely gonna grow up to be not right in the head. I don't know if for sure he would have grown up to be like this no matter what, but he was not gonna grow up to be right.
I'm 100% antisocial. Honestly, recording these podcasts, even though it's just with Jordan, my social battery is depleted for the entire week. I definitely have social anxiety, so I can feel the antisocial part. I don't like socializing. It's torture, being in the room with a bunch of people. Like, that's why I never really cared for parties as much, you know. But I'm also not a serial killer, and I wouldn't kill anybody.
Yeah, because it's kind of all at once.
To me, it's how they did it. Like, he obviously planned this out. He did everything he could to hide it as best as he could, even though he fucked up severely, obviously. I think that he definitely, if he went to got caught, he would have continued to kill. I think the killing was the escalation of the grave robbing and the weird arts and craft projects.
Yeah, it's super gross. And you can, I think you can still see some pictures of some of the arts projects online if you Google. And I don't know if you want to do that, because you don't.
I've actually seen the black and white pictures of that, and it's definitely...
It's grotesque.
I mean, on the surface, it's not bad until you realize what it actually is. Because if I remember right, didn't some of the things from his quote-unquote collection end up going to a museum or something?
Something like that. A lot of them ended up burning.
Yeah.
Not all of them, obviously, but some of them.
I definitely remember seeing the black and white pictures. And I don't know, something about black and white pictures that just makes stuff seem worse than they are, I guess. Not saying that this is not bad, but it just, to me, being in black or white makes it 10 times worse than what it is. It's bad on its own, but I don't know. Black and white pictures just are creepy.
There's something more haunting about it.
I don't know if there's a phobia of like black and white pictures, but if there is, I definitely have that. Because I will like visibly recourse when I see black and white pictures. I don't know what it is. It's just something about them. Like, it literally, to me, feels like evil.
That's really weird.
Yeah. Well, remember when we went to, was it the Sally house that had the, like, photos and stuff?
On the stairwell or something?
Yeah, and they had black and white pictures. That was creepy to me. I did everything I could to avoid looking at the pictures. I don't know, black and white pictures just freak me out. I'm so glad that they don't really do black and white pictures anymore, even though pretty much every phone has a stupid filter. Like, even my phone has a black and white filter, and I hate it. I accidentally put it on one of my pictures. I had to actually delete the picture because I couldn't figure out how to take it off.
So everyone as a group is doing black and white pictures.
Nope. Anybody post any black and white pictures on the Facebook page, I'm deleting them. Anyways, that's my rant. Good episode, though.
Yeah, he was a creepy guy with a creepy family, creepy habits.
So he's creepy like Jordan.
Sure. Sure, buddy. This story gave us some of the best and most well-known horror movies of our time. But two women lost their lives and many graves were disrupted, ultimately for our own entertainment. Sometimes the truth is scarier than fiction.
Picture this. The year is 1888. The streets of Whitechapel are blanketed in an eerie fog, and a sense of dread hangs heavy in the air. Women are found brutally murdered, their bodies horrifically mutilated, and fear spreads like wildfire through the community. The killer leaves no trace, no clue, just a chilling moniker whispered in hushed tones, Jack the Ripper. Who was this shadowy figure who evaded capture, outwitted the authorities, and struck terror into the hearts of Londoners? Was he a madman, a doctor, a butcher, or even a woman? Over a century has passed, and yet the identity of Jack the Ripper remains one of history's greatest mysteries. In this episode, we peel back the layers of this dark tale. We'll explore the gruesome details of his crimes, sift through the suspects, and delve into the theories that continue to fascinate and horrify. From contemporary accounts to modern forensic analysis, join us as we attempt to unmask Jack the Ripper. Before we begin, a few important notes. Only five victims are officially recognized as victims of Jack the Ripper, known as the Canonical Five. However, there are another possible six victims who were killed in the same area that could be connected. I'm including these six additional victims due to the likelihood that they may be connected. Also, be aware that this episode contains descriptions of mutilation, violence, and gore. Viewer discretion is advised. The first potential victim was Emma Elizabeth Smith. She was attacked at Osborne Street, Whitechapel, at approximately 1:30 a.m. on April 3, 1888. She had been bludgeoned on the face and had her ear cut. The more gruesome detail is she had a blunt object inserted inside her, rupturing her peritoneum, which is a membrane that lines the abdominal cavity and covers most of the organs in the abdomen. She developed peritonitis and died the following day. Smith was last seen at approximately 12:15 a.m. by 54-year-old Margaret Hayes. According to Hayes, Smith was standing near Ferrant Street, talking with a man dressed in dark clothing and a white scarf. Approximately 75 minutes later, Smith was attacked at the junction of Osborne Street and Brick Lane, Whitechapel. Smith stated that she had been attacked by two or three men, one of whom was possibly a teenager. It was common for prostitutes to be controlled by local gangs, and police believed that her gang was responsible for this attack. But what if it was Jack the Ripper's first victim, and Smith was too scared to say anything, but knew that if she said it was multiple men, they would dismiss it. The next possible victim was Martha Tabram. She was killed on August 7, 1888, on a staircase landing in George Yard, Whitechapel. She suffered 39 stab wounds from a bladed instrument such as a penknife. Her stab wounds include 9 in her throat, 5 in her left lung, 2 in her right lung, 1 in the heart, 5 in her liver, 2 in the spleen, and 6 in her stomach. She was discovered just before 5 a.m. by resident John Saunders Reeves as he was going to work. The coroner believes she was killed between 2:30 and 3:30 a.m. Husband and wife Joseph and Elizabeth Mahoney returned to the building at 2 a.m. and saw no one on the stairs. At 3:30 a.m., resident Albert George Crow returned home from work and noticed Tayron's body on the landing. But because the landing was dimly lit, he mistook her for a sleeping vagrant. Even though police at the time believed it was connected to the killings, many experts don't believe this is a victim of Jack the Ripper due to the inconsistent wound patterns from the other murders. Tayron didn't receive any slash wounds to her throat or abdomen. However, we know it is common for serial killers to evolve their pattern, and this isn't far off. What if this was the second victim and a police officer may have interacted with Jack the Ripper? At 2 a.m., a patrolling officer, Thomas Barrett, questioned a man loitering nearby who replied that he was waiting for a friend. The first of the canonical five and the third victim is Mary Ann Nichols. She was discovered on August 31st, 1888 at approximately 3:40 a.m. She was found on Bucks Row, Whitechapel, now known as Doorward Street. Charles Cross, a local carman, discovered the body while on his way to work. He was soon joined by another passerby, Robert Paul. Nichols was found lying on her back, her skirt raised above her knees, and blood around her. Nichols had 2 deep cuts across the throat, severing all the tissues down to her vertebrae. The lower wound nearly decapitated her. She also had several incisions causing extensive damage. A jagged wound ran from the lower part of her abdomen to the right side, revealing her intestines. On top of all that, she had various small cuts and bruises on her body, indicating a violent struggle or an attempt to fend off the attacker. Dr. Llewellyn, who was summoned to the scene, examined the body. He estimated the time of death to be 30 minutes to an hour before the body was found. Cause of death was determined to be loss of blood from the throat wounds. He also noted that the deep cuts to the throat and the abdominal mutilation suggested the use of a long-bladed knife. The skillful cuts indicated some anatomical knowledge, leading to speculation that the killer might have been a butcher or a doctor. The brutal nature and precision of the wounds marked the official beginning of what would become known as the Ripper Murders, characterized by increasing savagery and ritualistic elements. The second victim of the canonical five, and possible fourth overall, was Annie Chapman. She was discovered on Saturday, September 8, 1888, at approximately 6 a.m. in the backyard of 29 Hanbury Street. John Davis, an elderly resident of 29 Hanbury Street, found the body while leaving his home. Chapman was found lying on her back with her skirt pulled up and her legs bent. Her face was swollen and turned to the right. Chapman had 2 deep parallel cuts across the throat, severing all the tissues down to her vertebra, similar to the previous victims. She also had severe mutilation, including a deep vertical incision that opened up the abdominal cavity. The intestines were removed and placed over her right shoulder. Additional incisions around the genitals and the removal of the uterus indicated a methodical and deliberate approach. Dr. George Baxter Phillips, police surgeon, examined the body and estimated the time of death to be within a few hours of discovery, likely in the early hours of the morning. Elizabeth Long described having seen Chapman standing outside 29 Hanbury Street around 5:30 a.m. in the company of a dark-haired man wearing a dark overcoat. According to Long, the man had asked Chapman, "Will you?" to which Chapman replied, "Yes." The official cause of death was hemorrhage from the throat wounds and subsequent mutilation. The abdominal and genital mutilations suggested the use of a sharp, long-bladed knife. The removal of internal organs indicated a certain degree of anatomical knowledge and precision. The level of violence and specific targeting of the reproductive organs pointed to a sexually motivated crime. The third of the canonical five, and fifth overall, Elizabeth Stride, was found Sunday, September 30th, 1888, at 1 a.m. She was the first of 2 bodies discovered that night. Stride was discovered at Dutfield's Yard off Burner Street, Whitechapel. Lewis Deem Schultz, a local resident and club steward, found the body while driving his horse and cart into the yard. Stride was found laying on her side with her throat cut. Her body was still warm, indicating she had been killed very recently. Several witnesses later informed police they had seen Stride in the company of a man close to Burner Street on the evening of September 29th and in the early hours of September 30th, but each gave differing descriptions of the man. Stride had a single deep cut across the throat, severing the left carotid artery and windpipe. She had no other significant wounds or mutilations on the body, suggesting the killer may have been interrupted. Dr. Frederick Blackwell and Dr. George Baxter Phillips examined the body and estimated the time of death to be within 15 to 20 minutes of discovery. Cause of death was hemorrhage from the cut to the throat. The single deep cut was delivered with precision, severing major blood vessels. The fourth of the canonical five and the second of the night was Catherine Eddowes. She was found at 1:45 a.m., just 45 minutes after Stride at Mitre Square. Police Constable Edward Watkins discovered the body while patrolling his beat. Eddowes was found lying on her back with extensive mutilations to her face and abdomen. Her clothing was pulled up and her intestines were partially exposed. Eddowes had two deep parallel cuts across the throat, similar to the previous victims. She also had extensive mutilation, including a deep vertical incision and removal of internal organs. The intestines were placed over the right shoulder and the left kidney, and a portion of the uterus were removed. Mutilations included cuts to the eyelids, cheeks, and nose. A piece of her ear was cut off and discovered in her clothing later. Dr. Frederick Gordon Brown examined the body and estimated the time of death to be within 30 minutes to an hour of discovery. Cause of death was also hemorrhage from throat wounds and subsequent mutilation. The extensive mutilations and organ removal required an anatomical knowledge and precision. The facial mutilation suggested a deep-seated rage and intent to dehumanize the victim. The kidney and uterus removal were done with surgical precision. The last victim of the canonical five and seventh overall is Mary Jane Kelly, who was discovered November 9, 1888 at approximately 10:45 a.m. Kelly was found at 13 Miller's Court. Thomas Boyer, an assistant to landlord John McCarthy, found the body after being sent to collect overdue rent. Kelly was found lying on the bed in her small rented room. The body was extensively mutilated beyond recognition, with severe disfigurement and disembowelment. Kelly's throat was severed down to the spine, and her abdomen was extensively mutilated, with the organs removed and placed around the body. Her face was extensively disfigured with deep cuts, making identification difficult. She had multiple other lacerations and mutilations on the arms, legs, and torso. Her breasts were cut off and placed on the bedside table. Dr. Thomas Bond and George Baxter Phillips examined her body and determined her time of death to be in the early hours of the morning, likely between 2 a.m. and 8 a.m. Cause of death was hemorrhage from the severed carotid artery due to the throat wounds. The mutilations were the most extensive and horrific of all the Ripper victims. The abdomen was completely emptied and the organs were methodically placed around the room. Her heart was missing from the crime scene. The face was slashed beyond recognition and the extensive mutilations indicated a prolonged period of time spent at the crime scene. Multiple ashes found within the fireplace suggested Kelly's murderer had burned several combustible items to illuminate the single room as he mutilated her body. Another possible victim, the eighth overall, was Rose Milet. She was found December 20th, 1888, in the early morning hours at Clark's Yard off Poplar High Street. Police Constable George Allen found the body while on his beat. Milet was found lying on her back in the yard with no immediate signs of struggle. Milet had ligature marks around the neck suggesting strangulation and no other significant wounds or mutilations were found on the body. The body showed signs of slight bruising but no severe external injuries. Dr. Thomas Bond and George Baxter Phillips examined the body and found time of death to be a few hours before the body was discovered. Cause of death was initially believed to be strangulation due to ligature marks on the neck. The examination revealed that strangulation marks could have been caused by a soft ligature or manual strangulation. There were no signs of violent struggle or significant trauma. Police initially thought she died by accidentally hanging herself while drunk or committed suicide. But at an inquest, the jury determined her death to be murder. The lack of mutilations distinguished this case from the other Ripper victims. While Milet's death bore some superficial similarities to the Ripper murders, the lack of severe mutilations and the method of killing, strangulation, led some experts to doubt her inclusion as a Ripper victim. However, the circumstances of her death remained suspicious and added to the atmosphere of fear in Whitechapel. I personally don't believe she was the victim of Jack the Ripper, but she is often linked to the case, which is why I included her. Another possible victim, and ninth overall, is Alice McKenzie, who was discovered July 17, 1889, at approximately 12:50 a.m. at Castle Alley, Whitechapel. Police Constable Walter Andrews found the body during his patrol. McKenzie was found lying on her side in the alleyway with clear signs of violence. She had two deep cuts across the throat, one superficial and the other severing the carotid artery. She also had a long, jagged wound from the left breast to the navel, several other cuts and punctures on the abdomen. Multiple bruises on the face and body indicated a struggle prior to death. Dr. George Baxter Phillips and Dr. Thomas Bond examined the body. Time of death was estimated to be within an hour of the body being discovered. Cause of death was hemorrhage from the severed carotid artery. The throat cuts and the abdominal wounds were less precise compared to earlier Ripper victims. The presence of defensive wounds and bruises suggested a violent struggle. The lack of significant organ removal differed from the typical Ripper pattern. While the wounds bore some similarities to the Ripper murders, the less precise nature of the cuts and the presence of a struggle indicated possible differences in the method. There was speculation that Alice McKenzie's murder might have been committed by an imitator or that the Ripper's methods had evolved. It should be noted that Dr. Bond believed this to be another Ripper victim. However, Dr. Phillips did not.
I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue one last year.
I know, by a wide margin too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue one last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.
I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue one last year.
I know, by a wide margin, too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue one last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.
Another possible victim, number 10 overall, is a Jane Doe, known as the Pynchon Street Torso. It was discovered September 10, 1889 at approximately 5:15 a.m. under a railway arch on Pynchon Street. Police Constable William Pennant found the body while on his patrol. The body was a headless and limbless torso wrapped in a piece of cloth. The head and limbs had been expertly severed from the torso. The exact locations of these body parts were never found. There were deep incisions and some evidence of internal organs being removed. The dismemberment was carried out with a high degree of skill, suggesting the use of sharp, precise instruments. There was no other discernible wounds due to the advanced state of decomposition. Dr. Thomas Bond examined the remains and determined the time of death to be several days to a week before the body was discovered, based on the level of decomposition. The torso was believed to be of a 30 to 40-year-old female. Cause of death was unable to be determined due to the absence of the head and the advanced decomposition of the torso. The clean cuts and the manner of dismemberment indicated a degree of anatomical knowledge. The removal of the internal organs and the precise nature of the dismemberment were noted. This condition suggested it was unlikely that the death and dismemberment occurred at the same location where the torso was found. The case was categorized as a possible Ripper-related murder due to the similarities in the anatomical knowledge displayed. However, the method of dismemberment and the absence of other canonical Ripper trademarks led to significant debate. The final possible victim we'll talk about is Frances Coles, the 11th overall victim, possibly. She was found February 13, 1891, at approximately 2:15 a.m. at Swallow Gardens, a dark railway arch off Chamber Street. Police Constable Ernest Thompson found the body while on his patrol. Coles was found lying on her back with her eyes partially open and significant blood around her head and neck. Coles had a deep cut across the throat, severing the carotid artery and windpipe. Additional shallow cuts were found around the neck area, bruising and minor lacerations on the face, suggesting a violent struggle before death. She also had no significant mutilations to the abdomen or other parts of the body, unlike the earlier Ripper victims. Dr. George Baxter Phillips examined the body and found time of death to be within minutes before the body was discovered, as the body was still warm and the blood was fresh. Cause of death was hemorrhage from the deep cut to the throat. The cut to the throat was similar in nature to those inflicted on previous Ripper victims, though there were fewer mutilations. The minor facial injuries indicated a struggle, but the absence of abdominal mutilations suggested a potential deviation from the Ripper's known pattern. Since she was discovered within minutes of death, it's likely the killer was interrupted, explaining the lack of mutilations, which is why I believe it's likely she was the final victim of Jack the Ripper. The first letter received by presumably Jack the Ripper was the Dear Boss letter. It was dated September 25th, 1888, and received by the Central News Agency on September 27th. 2 days later, it was sent to Scotland Yard. Though the authenticity of the Dear Boss letter remains hotly debated, it is widely regarded as the first piece of communication signed by Jack the Ripper. Written in red ink and spanning two pages, the letter is riddled with spelling errors and punctuation errors. The tone is mocking, taunting the police, and alluding to future murders with a sinister confidence. Here is what the letter said. Dear boss, I keep on hearing the police have caught me, but they won't fix me just yet. I've laughed when they look so clever and talk about being on the right track. That joke about leather apron gave me real fits. I am down on whores and I shan't quit ripping them till I do get buckled. Grand work the last job was. I gave the lady no time to squeal. How can they catch me now? I love my work and want to start again. You will soon hear of me with my funny little games. I saved some of the proper red stuff in a ginger beer bottle over the last job to write with, but it went thick like glue and I can't use it. Red ink is fit enough, I hope. Ha ha. The next job I do, I shall clip the lady's ears off and send to the police officers just for jolly, wouldn't you? Keep this letter back till I do a bit more work, then give it out straight. My knife's so nice and sharp, I want to get to work right away if I get a chance. Good luck. Yours truly, Jack the Ripper. Don't mind me giving the trade name. P.S. Wasn't good enough to post this before I got all the red ink off my hands. Curse it. No luck yet. They say I'm a doctor now. Ha ha.
Okay, I'll be the first to say it. He sounds deranged.
Not gonna lie, that was like the hardest letter I've read.
I was watching your face as you were reading it, and you had to concentrate so hard to not like fix it as you were reading.
Yeah, it took every bit of me to actually read it correctly and as it was written. And that's the other thing is, we'll get into later letters. This one is the best one out of the three, I'd say.
Oh God, that's a nightmare.
Yeah, there's one. I'll show you the actual text of the letter. I'll have to do some like editing as I say it because there's a lot of misspelled words in there.
It's just, I can tell it was difficult, but it's deranged. Not just deranged as in, obviously, this guy is psycho, but deranged as in, like, the ha-ha and the everything else.
Yeah. Who actually puts ha-ha in the letter?
Yeah, exactly. And this was in the 1800s.
1888.
I'm sure that they got this letter and they were just like, what?
Yeah, and it's kind of weird. Like, it's almost taunting the police, but it wasn't actually sent to the police. It was sent to the news agency, and they forwarded it to the police. But it's just weird. The whole thing is just weird to me. But as we see in future letters, he does kind of give information that's not necessarily publicly available at the time.
So we're fairly certain the letters were actually from him.
Pretty sure. There's something I'll get into later on. But honestly, to me, it's not really conclusive or believable, honestly. But we'll get into that later on.
All right, fair.
The second letter, called the Saucy Jackie postcard, was postmarked and received on October 1st, 1888. The letter mentions the double murder the night before, and because of that, it is believed to be from Jack the Ripper. The letter indicated that he intended to sever the ears of the victims and send them to police, but was interrupted. The text of the postcard is as follows. I was not caught in dear old boss when I gave you the tip. You'll hear about Saucy Jackie's work tomorrow, double event this time. Number one squealed a bit, couldn't finish straight off. Had no time to get ears off for police. Thanks for keeping last letter back till I got to work again. Jack the Ripper. It is important to note that in 1931, journalist Fred Best of the Star claimed he and a colleague at the newspaper had written all the letters signed Jack the Ripper in order to keep the business alive. However, no evidence exists to prove this, and in my opinion, isn't the truth. In the years after the Ripper murders, the Saucy Jackie postcard disappeared from the police files. Although the Dear Boss letter was recovered in 1987, the Saucy Jackie postcard is still missing. In 2018, a forensic linguistic analyst found strong evidence suggesting that this postcard and the Dear Boss letter were written by the same person.
He's like, I tried, but I was interrupted.
What kind of is important about this one is the timing. So this was actually sent and received October 1st, the day after the double event. Not a lot of details were released. The fact that Eddowes had her ear cut off wasn't actually released to the public at that point.
But was it released to the media at all?
No, not at that point.
Okay.
That's one thing that they kept back. Because a lot of times you hear about police when they release, like, bits of the crimes, they'll leave back certain details so that if someone confesses, they kind of have that.
I think they call it guilt evidence.
Yeah. And that's one thing that they left back is the fact that her ear was actually cut off. So the timing, I think, definitely gives it credit that, you know, it was written by Jack the Ripper, which is one of the reasons why I don't really believe Fred Best, just because even he wouldn't have that information at that time.
No, he wouldn't. And it seems like he just wants some sort of fame.
Yeah, I don't know what his end game is, but to me, it seems kind of weird that he's confessing this. Obviously, if he's a journalist, at that point, anything that he's ever written is going to be called into question. So why would you ruin your entire career just to, you know, get that off your chest?
Well, yeah, and it doesn't make any sense because, like you said, it's going to put his career basically up in flames.
Granted, he was later in life, so he probably didn't have much time left anyways, but...
It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. He's over here like, actually, it was me. Which, for whatever reason, some people just have the need to be the center of everything.
Yeah.
And I'll never understand that.
I mean, honestly, he became semi-famous because now his name is attached to this case.
Which, I guess, makes some sense, but still, it's not attached in a good way.
No, but remember the kidney that we were talking about?
Ooh, yes. The missing kidney.
We find out what happens to it next.
Excellent.
Another letter purportedly from Jack the Ripper is the From Hell letter, or the Lusk letter. It was sent to George Lusk, chairman of the Whitechapel's Vigilance Committee, along with a half a preserved kidney. Lusk led the civilian efforts to assist the police in identifying and apprehending Jack the Ripper. The letter was postmarked October 15th, 1888, and was received by Lusk the following day. The author of the letter claimed to have fried and eaten the other half of the kidney. The text of the letter reads, From Hell, Mr. Lusk. Sir, I send you half the kidney I took from one woman, preserved it for you, to other piece I fried and ate. It was very nice. I may send you the bloody knife that took it out if you only wait a while longer. Signed, catch me if you can, Mr. Lusk. Now, let's get into the suspects. I have five most likely suspects. Now, over the years, there have been hundreds of possible suspects in this case. Some at the time, some later on. But I went through as many as I could, and I picked out the five that I believe is most likely to be Jack the Ripper. The first is Jacob Ishensmith, known as the Mad Pork Butcher. He was born in Switzerland in 1845 and immigrated to London, where he worked as a butcher. He was known to suffer from severe mental health issues, including paranoid delusions and violent tendencies, and was committed to asylums multiple times due to his erratic behavior. Evidence for him being Jack the Ripper is he lived and worked in Whitechapel, the epicenter of the Ripper murders. As a butcher, Ishensmith had the skills necessary to carry out the precise and brutal mutilations observed in the Ripper victims. He exhibited violent tendencies and was known to carry large knives aligning with the profile of the Ripper. Several contemporary accounts and descriptions of suspicious individuals near the crime scene matched his appearance. The evidence against Ishensmith is that he was confined to an asylum during some of the Ripper murders, providing him with an alibi for those specific dates. While his occupation gave him the skills, there is no direct evidence linking his methods of butchery to the specific anatomical knowledge required for the Ripper's precise mutilations. His severe mental illness and unpredictable behavior made it less likely for him to execute the calculated and methodical nature of the Ripper killings constantly. No physical evidence or direct connection was ever found linking Ishensmith to the crime scenes or the victims.
We are pretty sure that it was a doctor or a butcher to begin with, but do we know his whereabouts during any of that time?
All we know is that, at least for some of the murders, he was living in Whitechapel at the time.
Sketchy.
Yeah.
Because, like, I would have gone back. Like, okay, did the murder stop when he was, like, potentially in an asylum? Like, let's go back. Where were your whereabouts? Granted, we don't know for sure because we don't know.
Yeah.
It really all is circumstantial.
Yeah, and out of all the suspects, this is probably my least likely one. However, since he was a butcher, he definitely had the skills needed to do the mutilations, which is why I think he needed to be included. But yeah, he's by far my least likely out of the five.
I would agree with that, because it really honestly sounds like, well, this guy's a butcher in the area, and he's kind of wacko. We probably should look at him. Obviously, he does carry knives around with him, but that's really about all that he's got going for him being the butcher.
And I will say for all these, obviously the evidence is going to be circumstantial, but this is definitely the one that's the least likely out of all of them.
I would agree. I mean, technically, if they did find out who it was, they could find, like, the organs if he didn't eat them all. Blech.
He could have ate them all.
Gross.
But we'll get into another one who is a little bit better. The second possible suspect is George Chapman, born Saworian Antonowicz Kowalski. I butchered that name, I apologize. In Poland in 1865. Chapman was trained as a barber surgeon in Poland and worked as a barber in London. He moved to London in 1887, settling in Whitechapel. Chapman was convicted of poisoning three women in London, leading to his execution in 1903. Evidence for Chapman to be Jack the Ripper is he lived and worked in Whitechapel during the time of the Ripper murders. As a trained barber surgeon, Chapman possessed the anatomical knowledge required for the precise mutilations observed in the Ripper's victims. Chapman was known to have violent tendencies and a history of abusing women, aligning with the psychological profile of the Ripper. Inspector Frederick Aberline, a lead investigator in the Ripper case, believed Chapman could be the Ripper due to his proximity and violent history. Evidence against Chapman being the Ripper is that Chapman was known to poison his later victims, a stark contrast to the Ripper's brutal throat slashing and disembowelment. No physical evidence or direct witness testimony linked Chapman to the Ripper murders. The transition from violent, bloody murders to poisoning suggests a significant change in the killer's MO, which is atypical for serial killers, but not unheard of. While Chapman was in London during the murders, there is no clear timeline or alibi directly connecting him to the Ripper crime scenes.
I've actually heard of this one, and I've thought about it before, but especially the change in MO there at the end doesn't fit right for me. It's weird. I don't know. I don't buy this one.
It is weird, but again, it is not unheard of for serial killers to change their MO that drastically. There has been known cases where it has happened.
There just has to be a very specific reasoning behind it.
To be fair, some of the information that I found that may or may not be accurate was that the three women he poisoned were actually his wives.
Well, don't make the guy mad.
The lead investigator in the Ripper case did believe that Chapman could be the Ripper, but again, not my favorite. Definitely out of the hundreds, probably one of the leading suspects.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, my all-time favorite is the last one.
That's usually how you write it out.
The third suspect is Aaron Kosminski, who was born in Poland in 1865. Kosminski moved to London in the early 1880s, settling in Whitechapel, and worked as a hairdresser. He was known to suffer from severe mental health issues, including paranoid schizophrenia. He was eventually committed to a series of asylums. Evidence for Kosminski being the Ripper is that he lived and worked in Whitechapel during the time of the Ripper murders, placing him in the vicinity of the crime scenes. According to some reports, a key witness identified Kosminski as the Ripper, but refused to testify due to cultural and religious reasons. Kosminski exhibited violent tendencies and a deep-seated hatred of women, which fits the psychological profile of the Ripper. High-ranking officials, including Chief Inspector Donald Swanson and Assistant Commissioner Sir Robert Anderson, strongly believed Kosminski was the Ripper based on their investigation. Evidence against Kosminski being the Ripper is that Kosminski's severe mental illness and deteriorating condition may have impaired his ability to carry out the calculated and methodical nature of the Ripper murders. No physical evidence, such as forensic or eyewitness testimony, definitively linked Kosminski to the crime scenes or the victims. Kosminski was committed to an asylum in 1891, and while the Ripper murders ceased after 1891, allegedly, the lack of murders during this period does not conclusively prove his guilt. He also lacked the medical background to carry out the mutilations with precision.
Almost immediately, the more that I learned about this guy, the more I was like, I just really feel like it's not him.
It kind of starts out like, maybe this guy could be it. He's got some mental health issues. He hates women. He definitely had violent tendencies, but
he has no medical butcher, any sort of training.
Now, it is also worth noting that Chief Inspector Swanson and Assistant Commissioner Sir Robert Anderson strongly believe that he was the Ripper based on their investigations. But again, we have seen many times where the police have kind of latched onto a suspect and he wasn't the suspect.
So many times. They just get it in their head that it's got to be this person. And the thing is, you can fit that person to a T, but at the same time, like, I just don't know if he would have the physical capabilities to do it.
Obviously, they may know something that they never released that we don't know. A key witness identified him, but it is weird at the same time that they refused to testify due to cultural and religious reasons.
That is weird. Like, I can't think of any cultural or religious reason that would prevent you, but I don't know, whatever.
Maybe it was a woman who happened to be a sex worker too, and she didn't want her family to know that she was a sex worker.
Maybe. I feel like it's a little too far for you at that point, but okay.
I don't know. They never released, at least I couldn't find any information. It would kind of explain why the murder stopped after 1891 if the later murders were included in the Ripper killings, because he was committed to an asylum in 1891, which is the date of the last murder, allegedly. But again, not my favorite, but I definitely think he's high on the list. Now, next one is in some ways more believable, but also more not believable. The fourth suspect is William Henry Bury, who was born in 1859 in Stourbridge, England. Bury worked as a clerk and later as a sawdust salesman. He was known to have a volatile relationship with his wife, Ellen. They moved to London in 1887 and later to Dundee, Scotland. Evidence for Bury to be the Ripper is that he lived in Whitechapel during the time of the Ripper's murders, placing him near the crime scenes. He was known for violent tendencies towards his wife, Ellen. In February 1889, Bury murdered his wife, Ellen, by strangulation and subsequently dismembered her body, which bore some similarities to the Ripper's mutilations. During his trial, Bury reportedly claimed he had been advised to go to the police and confess that he was Jack the Ripper. Evidence against Bury being the Ripper is that Bury strangled his wife before mutilating her body, which differs from the Ripper's method of killing his victims through throat slashing and then mutilating them. No physical evidence or direct witness testimony linked Bury to the Ripper murders. Bury moved to Dundee shortly after the last Ripper murder, but there is no evidence that he was in Whitechapel during all of the Ripper killings. The murder of his wife occurred after the Ripper murders had ceased, suggesting his violent behavior might have emerged later rather than during the Ripper timeline.
Okay, that one's different.
So here is why I think this is actually possible. Because a lot of times with serial killers, the person that they are killing is usually somebody that is close to them. Usually like a mother, sometimes a wife.
Almost like a surrogate for that person, yes.
Yeah. So that's why I think maybe these women were surrogates for his wife, because he couldn't actually kill her until he finally did. Now, does that mean that he's actually Jack the Ripper? I don't know. I definitely think there is strong evidence that he might be. I think it's kind of weird that he claimed that he had been advised to go to the police and confess that he was Jack the Ripper. Not sure who advised him to do that, but...
I know, that's what I was thinking. I was like, okay, just going to randomly advise you to do that. Sounds great.
I definitely think there is strong evidence that he could be, based on the victims being surrogates for his wife. And then finally, he gets the courage to actually kill her.
I mean, it could make sense.
He's definitely on the top of the list for me, but not as good as the next one.
All right. All right, I'm ready.
Dr. Thomas Neil Cream is the last suspect we'll talk about. He was born in Scotland in 1850. He studied medicine at McGill University in Montreal, Canada, and further medical training in London. Dr. Cream practiced as a doctor primarily known for performing illegal abortions. He was convicted of several murders using poison, earning a reputation as a notorious serial killer. Evidence for Dr. Cream of being the Ripper is that as a trained doctor, Cream possessed the anatomical knowledge that could explain the precise mutilations seen in the Ripper's victims. Cream was in London during the late 1800s, overlapping with the period of the Ripper murders. Allegedly, Cream's last words before his execution were, "I am Jack the." His cryptic statement has fueled speculation that he was confessing to being Jack the Ripper. Although his known method of killing was poisoning, some theorists believe he could have varied his approach, especially given his medical expertise. Evidence against Dr. Cream being the Ripper is Cream's established method of murder was poisoning, which starkly contrasts with the Ripper's violent hands-on approach of slashing throats and mutilating bodies. Cream was allegedly imprisoned in Joliet Prison in Illinois from 1881 to 1891, overlapping with the period of the Ripper murders, making it impossible for him to be physically present in Whitechapel. No direct evidence or eyewitness testimony links Cream to the Ripper murders. The authenticity of Cream's alleged final words is debated among historians, with some considering it a myth or misinterpretation.
I was hoping this one made the list because I actually remembered a little bit about this one. I remember hearing about the last words, and it's like, who else was he going to confess to being?
Exactly.
Obviously, it's going to be Jack the Ripper.
So I will say he definitely, I think, is probably the most likely. And I say this because for the imprisonment in 1881 to 1891 in Illinois, records back then weren't the greatest. So the person who was incarcerated could have been a totally different person.
It's true.
If you ever looked up records for back then, it's very easy to get things mixed up and, you know, basically get the wrong person.
Well, or what if he even broke out for a little bit?
Could be. I don't think he was actually in Illinois, because everything else, there's no evidence of him ever actually being in the United States.
Oh, that's fair.
Definitely Canada when he went to college for being a doctor. And then obviously London. He was born in Scotland. There's no actual evidence showing that he was ever in the United States.
That's weird.
And obviously, the last word being, I am Jack the...
I mean, what? Was the next one going to be like Beanstalk? I don't know.
If those last words were accurate, which I guess it could be a myth. I don't like when like historians debate that this has actually happened just by saying, well, it's probably a myth or just a misinterpretation. If you think it's fake, you know, find evidence that it is fake.
Yeah, it seems pretty simple.
He definitely had the medical expertise. He definitely was a sociopath, I would say, at the least.
Yeah, he was a little messed up at the least.
And again, I've said it before, you know, the fact that he went from these mutilations to poisoning is atypical, but it's not unheard of.
Well, and if you think about it, what if that was just another way he was trying to hide? Like, he was showing his true self as Jack the Ripper, but what if the other stuff, I don't know, different methodology calls for different things.
Because honestly, if I ever became a serial killer, I would probably kill multiple ways just to kind of throw the scent off my trail. Not that I'd ever become a serial killer, but...
No, but if you did, you'd have to be smart about it.
Because honestly, like, it is so rare for serial killers to change their MO that consistently that I would do it just to mess with them.
Because everything's always like, oh, it's got to be the same guy because he did the exact same thing all the time.
I think he definitely is a strong suspect and one of my top, but not my very top suspect. We'll get into that now. Now, for a special theory and my personal favorite about Jack the Ripper. What if he wasn't a male at all? What if the killer was a woman known as Jill the Ripper? The Jill the Ripper theory suggests that Jack the Ripper could have been a woman. It was proposed by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, creator of Sherlock Holmes, who believed a female perpetrator could evade suspicion more easily. Victorian London was a patriarchal society where women were often underestimated and overlooked, making the idea of a female killer plausible to some. Evidence for Jill the Ripper is a woman, particularly a midwife, could move about at night without arousing suspicion. Bloodstains on her clothing would not be unusual for a midwife. Midwives or women with medical training would have the anatomical knowledge to perform the precise mutilations seen in the Ripper victims. Some witness descriptions of the individual seen with the victims before their death were vague enough to potentially include women. The societal norms of the time would have made it easier for a female killer to avoid suspicion, as women were not commonly viewed as capable of such violent acts. Evidence against this is that no concrete evidence directly points to a female suspect. All known letters and testimonies point to a male perpetrator. The brutal nature of the murders include the deep throat cuts and the severe mutilations suggest a level of physical strength more typical associated with men. Several eyewitnesses who saw individuals with the victim shortly before the deaths described men, not women. The theory primarily relies on challenging the male-centric assumptions of the time without providing substantial evidence to support the presence of a female killer.
Congratulations, I have not heard this theory, but I like it.
Oh, I can't believe you never heard of this.
Remember, I'm not the biggest serial killer person. I'm just not. But I really like the theory because it does make a lot of sense. Women can move about, especially like you said, as a midwife, and not be noticed.
And honestly, that's why I think it's very, very likely that this is the case, because a midwife wouldn't be suspected. She could have blood on her clothes and nobody would have a second look at her because it was common for midwives to get blood on their clothing.
Oh, yeah. All over.
And that would explain why, ultimately, the few eyewitness accounts that we have are very much before the murders, never after. So how could a man go that invisible, especially later on when everybody was on the high alert?
That makes sense. If they were looking for a man and it was a woman, she's still going to be completely, basically invisible at that point.
And, you know, it would explain the medical knowledge because she would have medical knowledge to be a midwife.
Honestly, you probably have to be pretty strong.
I don't think you'd have to be that strong, though, honestly. You get a heavy enough blade, but I do think that midwives would be stronger than probably most women.
There are certain things that, like, I think midwives would have to do, at least back then, that would require some amount of strength.
I think that a woman would have the physical strength to carry out the murders, at least in this context. Because it's not like she's, like, picking up the victims and carrying them for miles.
Yeah, right? I mean, the victim doesn't move.
So I definitely think that it is very possible that Jack the Ripper was a woman.
Although I do wonder then about her victims of choice, aside from them probably just being easier to get to.
I mean, there could be a lot of reasons for it. Maybe at one time she was a sex worker and she resented that. Or maybe she felt that sex workers were giving women bad names. There could be a whole lot of psychological reasons for the killings. Or again, it could be a surrogate. Maybe her mom was a sex worker and she wasn't taken care of. But I definitely think that this would explain the fact that nobody ever saw anybody, especially that double event when the killer suggests that he was interrupted. At that time, when the first body was discovered, when the second murder was happening, there was a lot of police presence in the area.
Oh, yeah. And nobody ever suspected a thing.
No. And the two murders weren't that far apart.
No. So everybody had to have been on high alert.
Any man in the area would have been looked at twice. But again, a midwife, even in that heightened state, wouldn't have been glanced at a second time by the police. Which is why I very much believe that this could possibly be explain the Jack the Ripper killings.
I like it. It makes sense. Bravo, sir.
You thought I only had 5 suspects.
You told me you only had 5.
I know. This technically isn't a suspect that doesn't actually name somebody. It's a very good theory. And the fact that it came from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle is kind of cool.
It is neat, but I like it.
I do too. Definitely my favorite. And so, as we conclude our journey through the foggy streets of Whitechapel, we are left with the haunted mystery of Jack the Ripper. Was the killer a madman, a doctor, a butcher, or even a woman? The shadowy figure who evaded capture and struck terror into the hearts of Londoners remains one of history's greatest mysteries. From Emma Elizabeth Smith to the controversial theory of Jill the Ripper, we've explored the gruesome details, sifted through the suspects, and delved into the theories that continue to fascinate and horrify. Each piece of the puzzle brings us closer, yet still leaves us in the dark.
Thank you for joining us on this journey through all things mysterious. Your engagement is what makes this so rewarding. If you've enjoyed uncovering these mysteries with us, please show your support by liking, subscribing, and following us on your favorite listening platform. For more intriguing content and ways to stay connected, don't forget to check us out on our links in the description below. Your involvement is the key to unlocking more thrilling mysteries.
As always, we keep you guessing.
I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue 1 last year.
I know, by a wide margin too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF. Donnelly Stewart Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.
Did you know that in Ohio, the state Supreme Court could just ignore the Reproductive Rights Amendment we passed last year?
But so many Ohioans voted for it.
That's why we need to keep extremists out of the court by voting for Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that.
Here's the trick. Just remember, don't stop fighting. DSF. Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes. If you supported issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue.